This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, April 25th, 2002. I'm Deepa Fernandez at Pacifica Station WBAI in New York. As the UN fact-finding team to Jenin continues to delay, independent investigations find horrific scenes in Jenin. Capitol Hill begins investigations of alleged anti-competitive behaviour of pharmaceutical corporations, while in Britain the free healthcare system is on the market to be privatised. And as the House approves federal dollars for abstinence-only education in schools, we'll hear what Harlem teenagers think. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. U.S. soldiers training Filipino troops to fight so-called Muslim extremists, accused of being linked to international terrorism, may soon join combat patrols on a southern Philippine island. Gurley Linao reports from Manila.
The Philippine and U.S. governments are discussing the plan, which officials say would further boost efforts to track down Abu Sayyaf rebels linked to Osama bin Laden. But opponents to U.S. presence in the country are not expected to take this new development sitting down. There are currently almost 1,000 American soldiers deployed in the southern Philippines for a six-month counterterrorism training exercise with Filipino troops. Officials say putting the U.S. forces at company-level units would allow them to provide real-time intelligence and advice to Filipino troops as they search for the rebels. An increase in the number of U.S. forces on Basilan, however, would be required, a detail opponents would certainly question since they believe there are already too many Americans there. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Gurley Lino in Manila.
U.S. Roman Catholic cardinals returned home today after meeting with the Pope and each other over the widening child sexual abuse scandal. Chuck Rosina reports from Boston.
Cardinal Law left Rome early this morning. He avoided the media while he was there, but at Rome International Airport, he was dogged by TV crews of the local Boston media. When asked why he didn't attend last night's Cardinal press conference, he replied, quote, "It was rather late, I had other things to do," unquote. Meanwhile, the Boston Archdiocese said yesterday that it was embarrassed to disclose that it had additional records in the case of Reverend Paul R. Shanley. According to today's Boston Globe, the documents showed that Law and other church officials allowed Shanley to continue working as a parish priest in Newton, Mass. And in California, even though they knew he had been accused of sexual misconduct. The Archdiocese said there was no attempt to hide these additional documents, but lawyers for the alleged victims find it suspicious that they were not released until after the Cardinals' meeting in Rome. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Chuck Rosina in Boston.
The United Nations Security Council called on Kosovo's interim government to help all displaced people back into the territory, while the Secretary General warns of a premature pullout of UN peacekeepers. Haider Rizvi has more from the UN.
Almost 3 years after the end of a bloody civil war, several thousand people, mostly ethnic Serbs, have yet to return to their homes and communities in Kosovo. In a new report on the UN Interim Administration Mission, or UNMIC, Secretary General Kofi Annan said there is much more to be done to strengthen the rule of law in Kosovo. The Security Council welcomed advances in Kosovo's political structures, but called on the leaders of provisional administration to take further steps to ensure security and human rights of all the people of Kosovo, including its Serb minority. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Heather Rizvi at the United Nations.
A San Francisco court has overturned another death sentence, making it the fifth one this year. Chris Bruni reports on the man convicted of killing a former co-worker, John Bisciotti.
Yesterday, the court upheld Bisciotti's murder conviction, but voted unanimously to reverse his death sentence. The justices agreed with a federal judge that Bisciotti's legal representation was woefully bad. William Foreman, who represented Bisciotti in federal court, says bad lawyering for death row inmates will only get worse in California.
I think there are a great many cases, death penalty cases from the 80s, that are now coming up for review, where a lot of lawyers were appointed who just had not done death penalty cases before, and more importantly, didn't bother to figure out how to do a death penalty case.
Prosecutors have indicated that they will appeal the case. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Chris Bruni in San Francisco.
Finally, 4,000 to 5,000 workers joined together at the Illinois State Capitol building to be heard. From the Urbana-Champaign Indy Media Center, Michael Peltis explains why.
Lame duck Governor George Ryan has proposed the closing of state prisons and mental health facilities as part of his proposal to balance the state's budget. U.S. Congressman Rod Blagojevich, the Democratic nominee for the November gubernatorial election, has attacked this approach of balancing the budget on the backs of state workers.
For 25 years, those in the governor's office have sold us short and sold us out. I don't know about you, but I say it is time for a change.
Reporting for the Urbana-Champaign Indy Media Center, this is Michael Feltus.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
In the latest Israeli invasion of Palestinian areas, the Israeli army has admitted it shot dead five Palestinian police officers. This comes as the Palestinian Authority convicted four Palestinians for last year's assassination of Israel's tourism minister. Free Speech Radio News correspondent Jeremy Scahill has more on today's developments in the Middle East.
A makeshift court inside Yasser Arafat's besieged compound handed down sentences as high as 18 years with hard labor to four Palestinians Israel says carried out the assassination of its tourism minister, Rehavam Zivi. Details of the proceedings against the four men are sketchy because they took place inside a compound that remains surrounded by the Israeli military. But it has been reported that Yasser Arafat personally approved the sentences. The Palestinian Information Minister Yasser Abed Rabo said he could not comment on the verdicts.
We don't have access to the president compound, and we don't have the ability to communicate with him. And because we don't know, in fact, what really happened in details.
Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon has said that Yasser Arafat will remain trapped inside the Ramallah compound until the four Palestinians sentenced today and others wanted by Israel are handed over. Sharon wasted no time in dismissing today's verdicts, demanding extradition instead. Ari Makel is a spokesperson for the Israeli government.
There's no doubt these men have to be handed over to Israel. The Oslo Accords that the Palestinians signed with us in 1993 are clear. People who are guilty or suspects of serious crimes in places where there's Israeli jurisdiction must be handed over to Israel.
Meanwhile, in Bethlehem, Israeli forces continue to surround the Church of the Nativity, where more than 230 people have been holed up for more than 3 weeks, including monks, priests, and nuns. Today, nine Palestinian youth were allowed out of the compound, along with two corpses of Palestinians killed by Israeli forces. A delegation from the European Union is on the ground trying to end the siege. This as Israel refuses to allow another international delegation to begin its work. The government is continuing its rejection of a United Nations fact-finding team put together by UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. Its mission? To investigate the Israeli onslaught of the Palestinian city and refugee camp of Jenin. Palestinian sources and international observers say the number of Palestinians killed at Jenin by Israeli forces goes well into the hundreds. Today, British Prime Minister Tony Blair called on Israel to let the team in to see for itself.
We've made it clear that we believe that the UN mission should go into Jenin. I think it is important for not just the Middle East peace process, not just for people who have suffered so much, but also for the reputation of Israel that the UN mission does go in.
As journalists and human rights organizations continue to trickle into Jenin, horrific stories of an Israeli massacre there emerge. Secretary of State Colin Powell and the Israeli government say there was no massacre. What the Palestinians say they need is for the UN to come in, see for itself, and then tell the world what really took place. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Jeremy Scahill.
While the world waits for the UN to make its mind up about the composition of the delegation to go to Jenin, London newspaper The Independent has unearthed evidence that tells a horrific story of what happened in Jenin. The Independent found that while Israeli operation clearly dealt a devastating blow to the militant organizations, nearly half of the Palestinians dead who have been identified so far were civilians, including women, children, and the elderly. Leading international human rights organization Human Rights Watch has also just released their findings of what occurred in Jenin. And we go now to senior Human Rights Watch researcher Peter Boquette, who did the fact-finding in Jenin. He joins us from Bethlehem.
We spent 4 days in the refugee camp documenting the abuses that took place. It should be remembered that the refugee camp was home to some 14,000 Palestinian civilians when the IDF carried out their military operation there certainly we found massive abuses inside the camp. We documented the killings of 50 people inside the camp, including at least 21 civilians. Those included several children, women, and old men. Also, the destruction in the camp is just massive. We counted the homes which had been destroyed. We came up with a count of 140 homes which had been completely leveled by the Israeli forces and another 200 which had been seriously damaged. That made an estimated 4,000 people, or a quarter of the population of the camp, homeless.
What about the claims that are being leveled at both sides that civilians, Palestinian civilians, were used as human shields?
Certainly we found in our research that Palestinian civilians, including some children, were used by the IDF to do some of their most dangerous work for them. Palestinian civilians were often taken from gunpoint from their homes during the fierce fighting and were forced to knock on the doors of neighbors, enter those homes first when the IDF was afraid the homes were booby-trapped, and then accompany the IDF when the IDF soldiers searched the home. That places Palestinian civilians in direct risk of harm and violates the IDF's obligation to protect civilian life inside the camp.
The IDF is also saying that, in fact, it was the Palestinian militias that refused to let Palestinian civilians leave Jenin. Did you find any evidence of this?
Certainly not. According to our information, and we talked to many people inside the camp, most of the civilians who remained in the camp were trapped by the fierce fighting. We interviewed many people who were forced to move from home to home inside the camp as the Israeli military used their helicopters to indiscriminately bomb civilian homes inside the camp. I talked to one person who had to go to three different homes as the homes he was staying in were being destroyed. So certainly we didn't find any evidence for the moment that Palestinian militants prevented civilians from leaving. It appears civilians were trapped by the fierce fighting.
What about the IDF claims that Jenin is a hotbed for the Palestinian militants and this was the only way they could root them out? How do you respond to that, having seen the evidence?
Well, there certainly were many Palestinian militants inside the camp, including leading members of the Islamic Jihad group, the Hamas group, and the Al-Aqsa Martyr Brigade. All three of those groups have been responsible for suicide bombings in the past, which is a crime condemned by Human Rights Watch as a crime against humanity. We think that the methods used by the IDF were indiscriminate and disproportionate in terms of their impact on the civilian population. The IDF may have a right to go after terrorist suspects in the West Bank and Gaza, but they do not have the right to violate international humanitarian law and create this kind of suffering for the civilian population in the West Bank.
Peter Bouquet, senior researcher for Human Rights Watch, who have produced the first major report coming out of the Jenin refugee camp. Thank you for joining us on Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you.
This week, the U.S. Federal Trade Commission announced it has reached a settlement with the Canadian pharmaceutical firm BioVail. It is the first enforcement action to result from the agency's investigation into the use of questionable patents by drug firms to bar generic medicines from entering the market. Also this week, while members of Congress work on healthcare legislation, lawmakers held hearings on Capitol Hill to investigate the alleged anti-competitive behavior of pharmaceutical corporations. Carter Mester has more from Capitol Hill.
Timothy Murris, chairman of the Federal Trade Commission, announced BioVail will divest the patent the company had registered illegally.
BioVail unlawfully acquired an exclusive patent license to protect its monopoly in the market for Tiazac and generic versions. We also allege that BioVail maintained its monopoly by wrongfully listing the acquired patent in the Orange Book and making misleading statements to the FDA.
The settlement does not fine the drug maker, nor does it call for an admission of wrongdoing. The Federal Trade Commission found BioVail unlawfully obtained a patent for their blood pressure and chest pain drug, Tiazac, to snuff out competition from generic drug manufacturers, poised to produce cheaper versions when the original patent expired. During a hearing on Capitol Hill on anti-competitive behavior, Murris testified his agency's investigation revealed a number of instances of corruption by pharmaceutical manufacturers.
The aggressiveness under the antitrust laws have appeared to have put a stop to these agreements between branded and generics to delay entry of the generics. There are new tactics being used.
Murris testified that brand name drug companies buy out generic competitors to delay their product, leading to less vigorous competition and higher prices. Murris also noted pharmaceutical companies have been manipulating loopholes in the 1984 Hatch-Waxman Act, a federal law that extends patents on brand name drugs while opening up the market to generic copies to boost competition. But the pharmaceutical industry opposes reforms to the law. The drug industry voiced concern that new legislation would hinder its ability to research and develop new drugs. The Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, or PhRMA, a trade group, says the 1984 federal law has helped usher in more than 8,000 generic products to the market. Some lawmakers on Capitol Hill agree with the drug makers, calling the pharmaceutical market robust. Louisiana Democrat Senator John Breaux.
Generics now, about 49% of all the drugs that are bought in this country. It used to be 19. So I think if we look at Hatch-Waxman about and ask the question, did it move the utilization of generics to the American public? The answer is clearly yes, it has done so.
Consumer groups do not deny that current federal law successfully brought more generics to the market, but they argue the numbers PhRMA cites are misleading. Generics have not increased market share over the past 8 years, while brand name drugs make up 92% of total sales. Ben Peck, legislative representative for Public Citizens Congress Watch, says the BioVail case represents part of a trend.
When a patent was listed for the long-acting form of the drug Tyvaso, the generic was bringing to market not the long-acting form, the regular form of the drug, yet they were still kept out of the market for 30 months because of this provision in the law, which means that generics are kept out regardless of the merits of the brand name company's claim.
According to the Generic Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, 50% of the patented drugs set to expire in 2000 were delayed, blocked, or do not have generic competition. In 2001, 70% of the patents set to expire do not have competition or have been blocked. Even as proposed reforms make the rounds on Capitol Hill, consumer advocates say it will be a tough battle against a very powerful pharmaceutical lobby. Again, Peck of Congress Watch.
The pharmaceutical industry is incredibly strong. They field a massive lobbying army on Capitol Hill and make good use of campaign cash to contribute to members of both parties.
According to the Center for Responsive Politics, in the year 2002, the pharmaceutical industry has already made over $10 million in contributions to both Democrats and Republicans. Last year, Fortune 500 ranked the $37 billion pharmaceutical industry as the most profitable industry in America, up from the $28 billion the industry earned when it ranked number one in the year 2000. On Capitol Hill, for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Kutta Mester.
The American healthcare system could be offering a new model for the British National Health Service, famous for offering the whole population free healthcare. The service is now in crisis, with treatment nearing third world standards in some areas. Although Prime Minister Tony Blair this week promised to carry the can on whether his Labour government can improve the NHS with higher taxes, many experts argue that privatisation is inevitable in the longer term. Anastasia Kershaw reports from London.
At the heart of Britain lies the world-famous National Health Service, with free healthcare for everyone. But the beat falters with cases hitting the news, such as patients forced to lie in hospital corridors for days before finding a bed. Many say we're seeing the death knell of free healthcare in the UK. Dr. Tim Evans from the Independent Healthcare Association in London says this is due to years of neglect.
In 1948-9, the government took into public ownership some 3,118 independent hospitals, homes and clinics. It is sad to say that as the years went by, politicians of all parties did not invest in it appropriately. Some made promises which the Labour government find difficult to fulfil. Because of all that, the government increasingly talk about the need for public-private partnerships.
This has led to lower healthcare standards. Dr. Evans shows the human perspective of this.
Someone told me recently that if you go into a British state hospital, you're likely to acquire an infection or an illness that you didn't have previously. You've got a 1 in 4 chance of that happening.
Dr. Eamon Butler, director of the Adam Smith Institute, says privatisation will stop the health service being a political pawn.
I think it'll be a very much better system than we have at the moment. One thing is absolutely sure, that the present system is organized completely around the convenience of politicians and not around the convenience of the patients. Nobody takes the views of patients very seriously. They lie in hospital wards longer than they need to. They have to queue up.
The government is looking at the American system, among others, for new ideas. But many health workers, including London Dr. Claire Gerada, suggest these systems offer a worrying future at odds with the ideals of the welfare state.
Even though I would earn considerably more money than I do now, I think it would be all too easy to forget the patients that most need our help, which is the poor, the disenfranchised, the sick, the elderly. And I think we would become a health service that essentially treated the fit, the relatively well-off and the articulate.
It will have more subtle effects on society, says Alison Pollock, a highly vocal opponent of privatisation, who works as head of health policy and health services research at London's UCL Hospital.
And society at large will suffer because everybody will become increasingly responsible for the risks and costs of care. We know that in the US, people don't move jobs or change jobs unless they can be sure that they will continue with their same health plan and the package of benefits. Such constraints have never operated in most of Europe. We move job without thought to the healthcare package or benefit we get because it's a universal package available for all. So therefore, when we move to a private voluntary insurance system, we will be making decisions increasingly around the risks and costs of healthcare.
The taxpayer funds the system now, but many say that free healthcare is no longer economical, with the demands of an ageing population and more expensive treatments on the market. Pollock declares that this attitude is wrong. Society makes choices about its priorities, and offering free healthcare is just one more decision.
Countries make political choices as to what kind of society they want to live in, and after that, they constrain the cost pressures, which are usually commercial, accordingly. The government needs to revisit the principles of the NHS. Universality, comprehensive care for all, and free at the point of delivery. These were goals that were achieved and have been achieved across the world.
Controversy reigns in the UK over the privatisation of other services, such as the railways. In this atmosphere, the NHS debate has become almost symbolic of the struggle. One worker at a London hospital who wants to stay anonymous for fear of losing her job just wishes that politicians would start thinking about people's lives for a change.
I don't think the health service should be a political football. I think they should concentrate on making it work, not shouting at each other and accusing everybody of failing.
As the battle hots up, many experts predict that some form of privatisation is inevitable. But we've yet to see whether this will bring Britain's National Health Service up to scratch. This is Anastasia Kershaw reporting from London.
As a House panel today endorsed funding for abstinence-only sex education for teenagers, defeating opponents who called for broader sex education curriculum that also included more information on birth control and sexually transmitted diseases, a government report said that there is still no evidence whether programs that push sexual abstinence prevent teen sex, pregnancy, or disease. These programs have multiplied in the 5 years since the 1996 welfare reform, where Congress directed almost $500 million to the effort. Welfare reform, which Congress must renew this year, includes $50 million for abstinence-only education, which the committee wants to continue. Federal funds are given to schools that teach an abstinence-only curriculum. Both sides in the debate in the House agreed that teenagers should get a strong abstinence message. But as April Rose, a Radio Roots reporter from Crossroads Middle School in Harlem, reports, the majority of teenage girls are not having babies.
I have been talking to parents and kids who are my age, about 13 and 14, whether or not kids can have boyfriends or girlfriends. This is interesting to me because my mother doesn't allow me to have a boyfriend because she thinks I am not responsible enough to be in a relationship with someone. So I wanted to see if this was true for other kids my age. And why? It seems that adults don't trust us kids to not have sex. I was surprised to find out some of my friends agree. This is my friend Aluchi. What do you think of about having sex at a young age?
I think that is very bad because you're not ready. I don't
A lot of teens these days are having babies at the age of 13 and up, and then when they have the baby, they find out that it's really hard, and then they have to quit school and all this stuff, and then you have to take care of their child till they're 18, and even then, you have to worry about somebody all for the rest of your life. So I feel that you shouldn't have sex until you get married.
Alexis, who is 14, raises a good point. Are the rules different for boys and girls? After all, it is us girls who get stuck with the babies. What do you think about having sex at a young age?
Me, I say that really it's not, I don't think that's cool for like someone like 13, between like at least 13 or 18. I feel that you really don't know what you're doing, and that's some, your virginity is something that you get, and once it's gone, especially for a girl, it's gone forever. I feel that you should wait to find the right one that you feel that you love and to consummate that in a good way. I don't think you should just waste it on anybody.
Carlton has a girlfriend and he's 14.
My mother really doesn't like the fact that I have a girlfriend, but she allows me to have one anyway. She really doesn't care. But she said there has to be no sexual activities because she wanted me to go to high school, and then she wants me to go to college, and then she wants me to get a good job and then think about all the rest of that stuff.
Have you ever done anything with your girlfriend pertaining to kissing or any of them bedroom scene stuff?
Well, no bedroom scenes, but we have kissed before.
So then I asked Carlton's mom, why does she feel comfortable talking to him about sex?
I don't know. I guess because I've told him everything about sex. I let him have a little bit of freedom. And I think he knows, you know, not saying that he's not going to experience it and not experiment with it. Not, you know, for all I know, he could have. But in my mind, I don't think so. I don't know. I just don't think that he's, I think he would come and tell me or mention it to me or, you know, in some kind of way that I would know that he has tried it or have had sex. Never meant to
make your daughter cry. It seems Carlton's mom is one of the rare parents that do trust their kids to have a relationship and not become a baby daddy. She explains more.
I've seen some children, parents who were really strict on them, and then when and these were females, and when the opportunity came for them to get out, they just went crazy. They went crazy. They was, you know, going with this one and going with that one and sleeping with this one and sleeping with that one, and it was all because the mother kept them tied down, you know, tied down. I mean, you have to give your children some leeway, and you know, hopefully they do the right thing.
So maybe Carlton's mom is right, because sometimes when we are not allowed to do something, we go behind our parents' back and do it anyway. Have you ever gotten caught with your boyfriend?
Yes, I have.
Okay. Where were you when you got caught?
I was outside of my apartment.
What were you doing?
I was kissing him. Okay.
Calling out to all parents, listen to us, your kids. We know us 13, 14-year-olds are too young to have sex. If you trust us, we won't have to go behind your backs. From a man who's strong enough to mention, kiss and caress and hold not long. For Radio Roots, I am Crossroads radio reporter April Rose.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.